All right, what time does the 10:15 podcast roll start? That's what I want to know. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to know. Oh, it starts right now. Look at that. It starts right now. How about that? Hey, everybody, it's Kai. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. It's the Tuesday show, the big show, the deep dive into a single urgent topic of the day. And I think, actually, today our topic is as urgent as anything is in this society today. Online behavior, hate speech, racism, misogyny, other terrible things that get said online, of which there are way too many, and how we can think about that as we try to exist in these weird, weird times.
Yeah, I mean, a lot has changed on this topic just over the past couple of months, and I think it's partly what we will talk about as potentially a long overdue recognition that speech online has offline consequences for individuals, for democracy, for information and trust. So we're starting to see social media companies be under increasing pressure, including from their advertisers. Over 100 companies have pulled ads from Facebook, which gets the most attention. But several of those companies are also boycotting social media writ large. Mm-hmm. And we want to talk about whether this is a turning point.
And we are going to be doing the talking with a guy by the name of Andrew Morantz. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker. He covers technology and social media, among a bunch of other stuff. His book on the topic at hand, actually, is Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. That's a great line, the hijacking of the American conversation. Andrew, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also, Andrew, we should say, like, you're the perfect guy to come on to an audio program because Morantz is the name of the equipment that we all do.
No relation. Totally.
No relation, I was wondering. But you were born for radio.
I know. I actually have had weird situations where I show up to an interview with a Morantz recorder, and the person interviewing is like, is this a giant conspiracy? Like, what is going on?
It's so meta.
Oh, man.
I love it.
Yep.
I discovered the other day that a lady who lives around the corner, her maiden name is Cessna, as in the airplane, and like she's from that family.
Oh,
so I thought that was cool. Yeah. Anyway, just because
she
I'm
is from the family.
All right. Anyway, but
okay. All right. We're off topic. I said, is
yeah,
she
we're
from
off topic. Let's get back. She is from that family. Yes, it's like her great great grandfather.
Awesome.
Her great grandfather. Somebody started. Yeah. Now I don't think she flies, but that's neither here nor there. So Andrew, to the topic at hand. After a brief diversion. This is not the first time we've had this conversation. We've been having this conversation for a long time. And the question is, I want to start with is, are we getting anywhere?
I'm gonna say yes and no. I mean, the good news is we're getting somewhere in the sense that, you know, when I started writing about this stuff, you know, around 2014, 2015, it was a very, very different conversation. So there were people who were saying, hey, there's a lot of really horrific stuff online. That, you know, that was being pointed out, but it was not really part of the mainstream conversation. You know, that was still, it's almost hard to remember at this point, but that was still back in the days where big tech kind of had a halo around it. And everyone was sort of talking about how social media gave us the Arab Spring and all this sort of stuff. And so it was very hard to advance a conversation of what I call in the book, the antisocial side of social media. Everyone wanted to talk about the pro-social side, how great it is, how nice it is for everyone to be connected. And that's obviously a real thing. But if you wanted to say like, hey, women are getting harassed, people are making memes about gas chambers, or even stuff that's less obviously horrific, but still very, very impactful, it was hard to get traction on that. So I think that's the good news, that it's a lot easier to have that conversation. It's much more widespread. You can get a national movement together. You can get a boycott together. Those things were kind of unthinkable a few years ago. But I think the bad news is that we have a long way to go, and the solutions are often Band-Aid solutions, and they're not fundamental solutions.
Yeah.
And you wrote this piece called Free Speech is Killing Us for the New York Times back last year. It seems hard to remember that there was a 2019, but there was. And one of the things you really did try to do, and I think this is really important, is sort of draw this bright line between online speech and offline consequences. And yet, it seems like this gap in understanding really still exists, right? Can you go through some of those examples and try to explain why people still don't think this is a real thing?
Yeah, look, and I think, you know, I don't want to create a straw man here because people who care about free speech are right to care about free speech. So, you know, there is a sense, a very, very important sense, in which when we talk about protecting free speech online, that is a really important thing. Sometimes it's deployed simplistically or cynically, but it is really, really a hugely important thing to keep in mind. So, you know, there's a law that's trying to move up through the legislature in Turkey right now where they're trying to regulate social media. But what will end up happening because of the way Turkey's autocratic government works is that will just be used as an excuse to censor people and possibly punish them for speech they don't like. So we definitely want to avoid that, right? So often you'll hear people say, we need more free speech. Free speech is good. We need to let everybody say everything they want online. And to that, I sort of say, your premise is super good and you're really heading in a good direction at the start of that. But then when you end that by saying, therefore, we can't do anything, nothing can ever be touched, nothing can ever be regulated, whether by governmental institutions or by private companies or whatever, that's when you go off the rails. So I think the main distinction is to say, free speech good, free speech important, but if that's where you stop the conversation, if you just sort of say, because free speech is good, therefore nothing can be done, and you just have to let people harass each other and threaten each other and lie and cheat and whatever, that's where I get off the train. Because I don't think you have to let all those things happen in the name of free speech.
Yeah, and I think the other part of it too, just to the beginning of what you were saying, Molly, about your question and how people are experiencing it. You know, I'm a privileged middle-aged white dude, and social media for me is a reasonably benign experience, right? But for you, Molly, as a woman, or for a minority, or for and here's a personal example, right? So about 3-4 years ago, I said something on Twitter, and somebody came back at me and said, and this may offend some listeners, I don't know. Somebody came back at me and said, oh, typical from a Jew like you. And I was like, what? You know, so I think the way it is experienced by different people in different groups really affects what gets done about it in the macro sense.
Yeah. And this is part of why I think it matters so much. This is one part of why it matters so much who is making the decisions at these companies, right? Because these companies were all, let's just be real about it, they were all started by young white guys, you know, who right. came out of Silicon Valley and wore hoodies and everything. That's all fine, you know, but it does give you a blinkered perspective. And I remember being at the Reddit headquarters in San Francisco when I was reporting on a lot of the stuff that Reddit was doing to crack down on hate speech and misinformation. And the general counsel there said this very insightful thing to me. She said, I know because I'm a black woman that my experience of social media is not necessarily everyone's experience. And so I can immediately, and she's in charge of making these decisions at this company, her and the CEO. And she sort of said to me, you know, it's really great to talk about free speech. I love free speech. I'm a lawyer. Obviously, I get that the First Amendment is important. But if I log on and I say something and there's a flood of responses saying, I know where you live, I'm going to set your house on fire, right? My speech is being impinged. So it's not just some benign abstraction to me to say, I say my thing and you say your thing. I know how this works in the real world.
Yeah. Well, and then even since, say, 2014 and Gamergate, which was, you know, of course, many people know, a big coordinated harassment campaign against female gamers that in retrospect was sort of the moment that I think we could have all seen how dangerous the speech can be and how it can spread, right? How hate is like a virus, how radicalization becomes a technique and a thing that can be accomplished online so that more people join a cause, and how social media can become the driver for, as you pointed out, something like the political campaigns of Donald Trump or Narendra Modi or Rodrigo Duterte. It's a force unto itself. And is the thing that people are still missing the idea that people are converted through this speech?
Oh, yeah.
That it's like a virus itself.
Right. Of course. I mean, it's funny, right? As you say, it's like a virus. It's funny that in our innocent pre-pandemic days, we would talk about something going viral and not associate right. that with negative consequences. Like,
with a bad thing? Right.
Right. How could something going viral possibly be bad for humanity? Right. So, of course, these things can have negative consequences. And of course, it's silly to think that, as you said earlier, that there's some super bright line between what is said online and what is done in the real world. It doesn't fit with what we know of human psychology and human behavior, that, okay, I'm going to spend all day getting my information from this screen and I'm going to learn things about the world. I'm going to get my opinions from it. And then I'm going to go into my life and it's going to have no impact on what I do or think or say. That's preposterous, right? If you're sitting, you know, where you get your information and the information you're getting is, I guess I should drink bleach to get rid of the coronavirus. that could have negative impacts on your behavior 5 minutes later, right? That's why it's so dangerous. And it's really interesting to watch how the social platforms are dealing with coronavirus specifically, because with those videos, the ones that are telling people, hey, you should drink bleach, or you shouldn't get tested, or you shouldn't wear a mask, they will take those videos down in a second, right? They'll take them down even if it's Donald Trump Jr. Twitter just suspended Donald Trump Jr.'s account for 12 hours because he retweeted that a video with false statements in it. So I applaud them for doing that. But what's interesting, right, is that they prioritize that kind of misinformation, but they don't prioritize other kinds, right? So they're aware that, you know, your free speech could impinge on people's right to, you know, not sneeze on somebody else and give them a deadly virus. But yet they don't make that call when it has to do with brigading women, or, you know, ganging up on people of color, or lying about voter fraud, or whatever, you know, any number of other things. So it's very tricky to know where to draw these lines. And I don't claim to have all the answers. But I think that the notion that there are no lines being drawn is a fiction. These lines are always being drawn. It's just a question of how and where we do it. And so for these companies to pretend, you know, we're just going to be neutral platforms and we don't have to make any decisions, it's blatantly false. They're making these decisions all the time.
So given that, let's run through the galaxy of people or companies or institutions or things whose job it is to at least try to ameliorate or rectify. I will not say fix, because I don't fundamentally think you can, but is it Mark Zuckerberg's and Facebook's? Is it ours, the people who use it? Is it governments? I mean, where does responsibility lie, do you think?
Yes, it's all of the above. It has to be all of the above. Yeah. I mean, if you think about this as a big complex crisis, you know, I've often, when I got toward the end of the research process and reporting process of writing this book, I really just started thinking of this as an informational crisis that is on par with the climate crisis or the opiate crisis, or, you know, these big complex things. If you were to say, well, who's going to solve the climate crisis? You know, should it be ExxonMobil, or should it be the government, or should it be all of us? The answer would have to be yes to all of it. It would have to be all of us, because it's such a massive undertaking. It's so complex. It's a result of all these little decisions that we've made over the years that we now can see in retrospect have all these tragic byproducts and consequences. And I think it's a really similar thing with social media. It's like as if, you know, when we designed our cities, we designed them with this great feature that, hey, we can drive out to the suburbs and back and it'll be really quick and there's no externality to that. And then it turns out, oh, there was an externality all along. It's called, we're destroying the planet, right? We did a similar thing the way we built online speech systems, where we said, hey, everyone's connected, everyone's together, it's frictionless, we're connecting the world, and it's going to be really open, and it's going to bring everyone together. And it turned out it had this creeping, invisible kind of emission as well, which had to do with sort of destroying democracy.
That's such a great analogy. Holy cow. Holy cow. So we're doomed then. Is that what you're saying? Right? Sorry.
Come on. But no, exactly. It points to how big and I think that's exactly where this conversation has to go, is like up the ladder from someone getting yelled at on Twitter to a systemic and fundamentally poisoned ecosystem.
Right.
That will destroy us all. I mean, you have people who don't believe a thing they read. You have QAnon, which is essentially a cult. You know, it's been described just this week in a Bloomberg piece as a cult recruiting people online in all these with all these different tentacles. That's going to be incredibly hard to stamp out. And I think you make a really good point that until we start to think of this as an ecosystem and a holistic problem, it's going to be hard to address. What is then the media's role? Like, we need to turn this lens on ourselves too and say, we're kidding ourselves if we think we're not reading this stuff and then picking these stories up and then amplifying them too.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a huge part of it. And I actually think that's why, you know, occasionally people will sort of say to me, why do you spend so much time paying attention to fringe things you see online? I mean, aren't you supposed to not feed the trolls? Aren't you supposed to not give these people oxygen? Why don't you just ignore them? And I think that's a good thought and a good critique. And the fact is, often I do ignore them, because often when something doesn't rise to a certain threshold of newsworthiness, you don't want to pour gasoline on the flames or pour oxygen on the flames, to keep my metaphor somewhat consistent. But I do think when it reaches a certain threshold, like you mentioned QAnon, when it gets to a point where, you know, Michael Flynn is giving a QAnon oath after getting out of prison, when the president is retweeting QAnon accounts, at that point, you can't ignore it. And you actually have to do the work of explaining and contextualizing and debunking it, which is the media's role. So I don't think these things are ever simple. And I don't think you can ever have a one size fits all solution to when you should pay attention and when you should ignore and the extent to which you should weigh it in. I think those are all tricky case by case situations. But I think you're totally right that the media is a huge part of this ecosystem. And a big part of why I paid so much attention to Twitter trolls, for example, is that Twitter is, for better or worse, I think for worse, Twitter is the assignment editor of the media. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. the fact that you can hijack the conversation on Twitter as some anonymous propagandist or troll or, you know, political ne'er-do-well or amateur snake oil salesman or whoever you are, the fact that you can hijack the mainstream media's collective brain and get the mainstream media mm-hmm. to do your bidding is precisely the problem.
So in this moment, right, we are facing a crisis over civil rights in this country and a crisis over public health in this country that, generally speaking, large majorities of Americans agree need to be addressed and solved. But at the same time, we're facing a political crisis in this country that we don't agree can be addressed and solved because we are so horribly divided. Do you think it's possible to come out of this with any step closer to a solution?
Yeah, I do. I often get right up to the point where I start to say we're doomed. And then I think the way I walk back from that is not to say, oh, well, I'm sure it'll all just work itself out. But to say, like something on the scale of the climate crisis, you have to work your way out of it, right? I think climate is a useful, I mean, it's both terrifying to think of it as a second climate crisis, but it's also useful in the sense that we know basically what we have to do to ameliorate the climate crisis. It's just really, really hard, and it's going to take a generation of work. So I think with this, it's not actually a total mystery how to get out of this. You know, you often hear people, especially people who are representing these big companies, they'll often say, well, what are you going to do? It's human nature. And sometimes people are bad, you know, they have ill intentions, they get snookered by bad information. That's just life. And that's just part of an open society. That's true to a point. But these algorithms are set up they tilted the playing field very early on in ways that they may or may not have been aware of. When you incentivize emotional engagement, when you incentivize what social scientists call high activation emotions, you are creating the conditions that make something like a video saying don't wear a mask become super viral. Not to, you know, pile on the virus analogy, but
yeah.
You've tilted the playing field, right? So it's kind of like designing a casino where all the visual and social cues are trying to nudge you toward the slot machine. And then saying, well, what are you going to do? It's human nature. People like slot machines, right? They've built a system that privileges certain kinds of content above others. And then we talk about the very, very end of that. We talk all the way downstream about, are you going to ban this or are you going to ban that? But we're not talking about addressing the root problem, which is how the algorithms are built.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Marantz, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Antisocial, wow. Online Extremist Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thanks. The whole book is not that much of a bummer, but I do have to, you know, sometimes you gotta, you know, shake people by the shoulders. But I do think, you know, we do have a chance to turn this ship around. And
yeah.
I don't think it's actually as hard. I actually don't think it's as hard as the climate crisis. I just think, as you guys say, it takes talking about it on those terms before you can start to ameliorate it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be honest, sure. Andrew, you're like the most hopeful guest we've had in months. So
awesome.
One thing at a time. Thank you so much. Take good care.
All right. Bye.
That was good. That was good convo.
Yeah, I know. That's great. And I feel like it's funny. It's hard for me, right? Cause this is my beat and I cover this all the time or whatever.
I think
he did such a great job of, I want to hear from you all and let you know if that finally, if it made sense, if it hadn't before, please tell us. And we should note that this is happening in the context of just yesterday, another one of these, a video of a press conference held by a discredited doctor who basically was saying masks are dangerous and the virus is a hoax went viral again. Just yesterday had like 6 million or 60 million views in some short amount of time on Facebook before they finally took it down. And we're having this conversation. In the context of the fact that tomorrow, we believe, Wednesday, is the rescheduled date for the four big trust CEOs. It's like a Gilded Age collection. Yeah. Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and Google all expected to testify in front of an antitrust subcommittee in the House. And you know that this is going to get all messy with respect to speech because you have a whole faction of the GOP saying that, in fact, the way that they manipulate speech is to discriminate against conservative speech, even though there's no evidence of that. And so you actually have a weird information ecosystem mess even going to happen tomorrow in Congress. Can't wait. Good times. Yep. So fun.
Good stuff.
Send us your thoughts. Make me smart at marketplace.org. That's the TLDR of what I was trying to say there. Email us. Okay. Be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Okay.
Back. Oh, hey.
We just came right back.
I know. It's kind of amazing. All right. Go ahead. You go.
You were right. You were totally right. You were super duper right about Garmin. Not only that it was a ransomware attack that they weren't telling people about, which was crazy, but also that it was like a super big deal. I cannot believe how many people were tweeting about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I owe you an apology for seeing your original tweet and being Garmin. Who Garmins? And then tons of people. Turns out tons of people Garmin. And it was a big deal that it went down. Yeah. It still is a big deal.
Yeah, it's still a little janky, actually, the app and my watch and all that jazz. But yeah, you get to the actual substantive part of this. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. The company is now saying that it had no indication that customer data was accessed, lost, or stolen. But the problem is that this is textbook how not to handle your situation. Yeah. So since they sort of weren't upfront with consumers for so many days, I think it's probably only a matter of hours now before they're like, okay, well, yes, turns out customer data was accessed, lost, or stolen. But then there's also this whole crazy other geopolitical thing, which is also maybe why they didn't come out with it right away. It sounds like, according to TechCrunch, the attack was caused by this wasted locker ransomware, which is known to be used by this Russian hacking group called Evil Core, which is funny, but they're not funny. They were sanctioned by the United States Treasury last year. And so because the Treasury Department has imposed sanctions on this Evil Core, they effectively made it illegal for a U.S. company to pay the ransom to get their files back.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this story fascinating. I think this is going to be fascinating for weeks because now what do they do? Does this mean they paid? Did they like hack back and get their access? And if they paid, are they in violation of these Treasury sanctions? I mean, like, it is a crazy story.
It is bananas.
That you just stumbled on because it is bananas. You're like a runner with a watch on.
Because
it's banana pants.
And I'm cranky about it. I was just cranky about it. There's mm-hmm. also, just parenthetically, an aviation subcomponent to this too, right? Because Garmin makes yes. navigation apps for aviation, and they couldn't download. And that's like a big FAA thing. So it's a big deal.
It's a super big deal. Yeah. Yep. Called yeah. it. Kai so was right on that one.
Boom. Boom. Anyway, so mine is less substantive, actually, and I think it's interesting how substantive mm-hmm. this Garmin thing is turning out to be, but economically quite relevant, and it's that the Consumer Electronics Show this year, to which you have gone for I don't know how many years in a row, Molly Wood, is going to be, wow, really?
20. I am so
old. Oh, my goodness. So you started when you were like seven? It's going to be all online this year. And I mention it for two reasons. One is to point out that Comic-Con was virtual this year and mm-hmm. generally did not meet expectations, which gets me to point number two, which is that virtual conferences, why? How's that going to work? Do yeah. you want to do that? Can anybody make money from that? What's the trickle-down effect from the Consumer Electronics Show? Being virtual, just in terms of the companies who usually go and roll out their thing and get lots of buzz and gadgets and this and that. And I just think we, for even as much as every day we say, oh, this is going to have big economic consequences, every time you turn around, there's another thing that in the out months, right? Because just because in January this conference goes away, you know, the net effects are going to show up like in March, April, May of next year. And I just, we're not putting that in the matrix, in the formula, you know?
Yeah. Because conferences, this is actually a really yeah. substantive story despite your setup because, well, on the one hand, I think the whole tech industry right now is having a little I told you so moment because CES just sort of confidently yeah. announced a couple of months ago, like, mm-hmm. we're definitely holding CES in January. And for those who aren't that familiar, this is like 170,000 people come from all over the world. Everybody always gets sick at CES. And only a couple of months ago when they confidently announced they'd be returning to Las Vegas in January, mm-hmm. was there mm-hmm. news that, in fact, coronavirus had likely been circulating at CES last January.
Right.
I mean, right. It was such an absurd call, but it does show you yeah. how much money is attached to these things. And that's so interesting that you bring that up because I have definitely talked to people who have paid for online conferences. And I participated in the New Fronts, which was like a 4-day long thing. Yeah. And the result, there was a piece in Adweek after that was like, yeah, I mean, people really like the host. Scott Rogowski, he was great. But it was like 4 days of 4 hours of sitting there staring at Zooms. Like conferences, it turns out, are a thing that are quite specifically not replicatable online. And that has, you said, that's big money.
Yeah. Sorry, 4 days of 4 hours sitting there staring at Zoom makes me think of the fate that my children and your child and many other people's children are in for when school starts. And that ain't sustainable.
Wah,
right?
Wah.
Yeah.
My poor baby.
Yeah. I know.
My heart breaks for my child every day. Every day. And everybody else's.
Okay.
Let's
get to all
way.
Y'all. There you go. That's right.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Amen. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about some things that have been on the pod and in the news last couple of weeks. Number one of which is unemployment benefits going away, extended unemployment benefits. Also, eviction protections, federal eviction protections are going away. August 1st is approaching. Rents are due. So what's going to happen? Rob Levine is a renter and a landlord all at the same time. Wanted to share his perspective. Here it is.
Hi, Kai and Molly, and sometimes Kimberly. This is Rob from Alameda, California. I am both a tenant here in California, where housing is bonkers level expensive, and a landlord in Detroit, where I have an investment property. Thankfully, my tenants have been able to pay their rent. But if they were in trouble, I'd much rather accept less rent so that I can pay the mortgage than kick them out and potentially have no income generated by the property, in which case I'd have a mortgage that I couldn't afford. It seems to me that for a landlord, an eviction in this economic climate would be akin to cutting off one's nose to spite the face, not to mention heartless and cruel.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But it's it, that's so what we yeah, well, that's what I was just going to say. What we just heard was the experience of a small-ish landlord, right, who's maybe got a couple of units or whatever, as opposed to big corporate and conglomerate landlords who don't care about that kind of thing, right, as much, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this this double argument. On the one hand, like, where are you going to find another tenant? You would have this, you know, mortgage that you couldn't afford without being able to rent the property. But this gets back to this thing we've kind of like glanced by a bunch of times on the show, which is like private equity bought up all this housing stock during the recession, the Great Recession. What are we going to now? I mean, great is looking kind of minor, actually, in retrospect. We're going to have to rename the last one. So that we can reserve great for this one, unless this one is the super duper recession. Anyway, there is a lot of corporate ownership of lots and lots and lots and lots of properties. And it's very likely that, yes, there will be some heartless cruelty and maybe even some cutting off of noses because they can absorb it. Yeah.
Yep.
But Rob, good for you, buddy. Love that. Okay, so massive unemployment and how to address it has been. I should also note here that our producers put in the Slack earlier a story that says that it looks like the eviction moratoriums are not part of, and a continued eviction moratorium at the federal level is not part of the Senate HEALS Act proposal, it appears.
Right.
So there's that. Yep. Massive unemployment, in addition to the housing crisis and how to address that, has, of course, been a dominant economic story these days. And now the extra $600 per month in benefits remain the biggest point of contention. Republicans in that proposal introduced last night would drop that from $600 to $200 per month. Listener John Pearson wanted to share his perspective on that.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is John Pearson. I live in New York State. I'm a very moderate Republican who will not vote for Trump. However, you totally denigrate the Republicans for not supporting a renewal of the $600. You were really saying that an unemployment benefit that was equivalent to 70% of someone's spending was totally inadequate. And what do Republicans want to do? Ruin the economy? It's a difficult thing. I sincerely believe that we need to send some money to the states, and I sincerely believe that we need to be generous with the unemployment. However, that extra $600 does make it so people don't want to go back to work. It also is way more money than we can afford. We can't keep having these multi-trillion dollar spending packages.
So, Ms. Pearson, thanks for your thoughts, sir. I appreciate them. I think we also ought to consider that maybe people aren't going back to work because there aren't jobs out there or they don't want to risk their health for jobs. I think that has to be factored into the equation. And there's actually some work that's shown that that's actually what's happening. On the idea of multi-trillion dollar rescue packages, first of all, if not now, when? And somehow it's okay to have $1.3 trillion deficit finance tax cuts, but not aid to Americans who have been thrown out of work through no fault of their own. I mean, look, I hear what you're saying, and there's got to be a happy medium somewhere. But if not now on these spending packages, when? Because when this goes away, and look, it's going to be 2 weeks at best before there's a deal, and we're going to feel that gap. We're going to feel that gap in the numbers and in economic performance. But, you know.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I couldn't agree more that we can't, or more importantly, shouldn't keep having multi-trillion dollar spending packages. I think there's a real strong argument that we could have had like one that was combined with a coordinated public health response that would have actually knocked the virus down. And instead, and you know, I mean, I think people agree that one of the only things that was done well in this country in response to this virus was the economic support. Even though big parts of it were not done well, it made a big difference and could continue to make a big difference if combined with a coordinated public health response that will actually knock the virus down. Without that, then we're in a situation where we're not knocking the virus down and we're not supporting workers at a level that will keep them in their homes and keep them fed. I mean, that's literally what we're talking about with some. And so if a small number of people are not going back to work because of that extra $600, and evidence suggests that when they have the opportunity to safely return to work, they'd rather do that. I think that's far outweighed by the devastation that will occur if we don't take care of people until we get this stupid thing under control. Like, there's literally one solution to everything that we are talking about right now. And that's the part that makes me lose my mind. There is literally one solution. Fix the virus. Like, it's just embarrassing at this point. It's just embarrassing. One solution. So with you. I do not want another multi-trillion dollar spending package because we shouldn't need it. God, just all angry now. I'm not yelling at you, John. I'm super stoked that you called us.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. We should have more like this. Call us on our stuff, yep. Right? We stay stuff yep. on this podcast. And all y'all ought to call us on our stuff. For yeah. reals.
And it's a perspective. Like, I'm not going to, it's of course, yeah. it's a perspective. We talk to, you know, I mean, the goal at Marketplace is to talk to people every day who are living in this economy. And so John, I'm thrilled that you called us with this perspective. And on this one part, I couldn't agree with you more.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. All right. We end, as we always do, the Make Me Smart question this week comes from Andrew Bessner. He's a member of the United States Air Force, about diversity and representation in the services. Here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. My name is Andrew Pesner. I'm a captain in the U.S. Air Force, and my opinion does not represent the Air Force or the Department of Defense. Something I thought I knew, but later found out I was wrong about, was that minorities are relatively well represented in the military. While true, I was wrong about their distribution among the ranks. Minorities are overrepresented in the enlisted ranks, but underrepresented in the officer corps. I'm a Hispanic man, and I can count on one hand the number of other Hispanic officers I've encountered in the Air Force, and only one outranked me. Adding in other racial minorities, there's still been less than 10 in the units I've been a part of. There's definitely been a shortage of people of color I've encountered that I could model a career after. I'm currently deployed to the Middle East, and I found myself in the position of being one of two officers of color in my squadron, and probably the only officer of color many of our enlisted airmen work with daily. Knowing this, I try not only to be a good officer, but a role model for our junior minority airmen who hope to make federal service a career. I've become more aware of how implicit bias has a direct effect on those under me. I try to address it when I can, but when the military structure puts up roadblocks, to just be there for them and check in when I can't. I've learned that despite progress, the military still has a ways to go for racial equality.
Yeah, that mirrors my experience to a T. And what's really discouraging about that is that my experience was years ago, not today, but clearly not much has changed.
Yeah.
Clearly not much has changed, but that's a good note, and it's a good... It's a good point to remember.
Thank you. Yep. And it's systemic. God, we have some cool callers today. I love this.
Those were good.
Yes, definitely. Thank you. Thanks everybody who called us. Please keep it coming. We absolutely love the voicemails. Send those and your thoughts and your emails to makemesmart@marketplace.org. And if you just need more of us every day, even though we're daily, check out our smart speaker explainers. If you haven't already, you just ask your Echo device to make me smart. It's just like one of us at a time. Maybe it's more accessible.
Yeah.
And then, of course, tomorrow is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? So send those in. makemesmart@marketplace.org, subject line questions. See you then.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Ben Hepcoat, that's me, is our video producer. And Ethan Parrots is our video intern. Thank you to everyone who has subscribed to our YouTube channel and helped us reach 100,000 subscribers. Finally. And thanks to writer-producer Erica Phillips.
Finally!
Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe and mixed by Garrett Lang. Our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Oh my God, 100,000 subscribers!
Yeah, we do. But also, what's great is when they do it, they each have their own little pet causes they want to get out there. Ben with the video and whatever. I just think that's great. More power.
Although that's totally appropriate because we should celebrate 100,000 subscribers. That is awesome.
For sure.
My 13-year-old would not be impressed, but I am.
All right. There we go.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.